This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. So, no mai, haere mai, welcome to Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. I'm your host, Sally Carlson, and today we've got a pretty eminent panel speaking about Antarctica. Brian Story, Dan Price, and Karen Scott. There's something different for this show. This is the first show we're doing in front of an audience, and I want to say thank you to COCA very much for having us. The Centre of Contemporary Art is currently hosting an exhibition called Precarious Nature, and Antarctica obviously ties in very well with that topic. The exhibition's on until the 19th of Feb, so here's a bit of a plug, go in and check it out. This is our first recording, as I said, in front of an audience, so also thank you guys for coming along. Now, to start with, it might be great to hear from our panel. They've all got a lot of experience in Antarctica, so it would be fantastic to hear what is that experience. Brian, maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Brian Story. So I trained as a geologist, and I think being a geologist, that gives you a sort of real perspective on change, on sort of really long-term change. We're used to dealing with the continents moving, climate changing, and so on. And I trained in Ireland and England, and then I got a job in 1974 with the British Antarctic Survey, and that took me initially just straight out of university down to the Antarctic. In fact, sailed down by boat in those days, which was a really fantastic experience. And I worked there really till 2000 and had the opportunity to work on the other side of the continent, the sort of South American side of the continent, before coming here to New Zealand in the year 2000. And I'm now a professor of Antarctic studies at the University of Canterbury and director of Gateway Antarctica, which is our centre for Antarctic studies and research at the University of Canterbury. So yeah, I've been to the Antarctic about 18 times and spent more than 3 years of my life actually in a pyramid tent out in the Antarctic, away from bases and stuff. So yeah, it's been a great experience.
We were just saying before as well, it's something that not many people get to do in their lifetimes. Dan?
Yeah, so I'm Dan Price. I don't have anywhere near the amount of Antarctic experience as Brian does. I've done 3 field seasons to the Antarctic, and my work is mostly associated with satellite remote sensing. So flying around the Earth right now, there are a whole bunch of Earth observation platforms is the technical name for them, and they monitor what's happening on the globe with radars and LIDARs and all sorts of things, and we use those to monitor changes in the ice thickness. And my PhD at Gateway Antarctica was concerned with mapping the thickness of the sea ice in the Southern Ocean. So I spent 3 or 4 years doing that. And after being sort of involved in the climate side of things since I studied my undergrad and understanding the science of it, I moved on to sort of advocacy. So in 2015, I started a project called Pole to Paris. At the end of 2015, there was a huge climate conference in Paris called COP21, which is sort of a pivotal moment in the global climate negotiations. And it just was kind of painful to me that no one really knew it was happening. My parents didn't even know it was happening. So I found that quite distressing. So we started a project with a bunch of great friends, and I cycled to Paris, and the idea was to just raise public awareness ahead of that. So I did a speaking tour on the way, and we made videos and made some films about climate change. We focused on Bangladesh, so when I cycled through Bangladesh, we made a film called 30 Million, which talks about the impact of sea level rise in Bangladesh. So this will tie quite nicely back to the Antarctic a bit later on, how this continent hidden at the bottom of the planet really is linked to all of us. So ended up in Paris, and since then I've carried on with the filmmaking, and I've come back to New Zealand as well to carry on with a bit of research. So that's about it for me.
Thanks, Sally. I'm Karen Scott. I'm a professor of law at the University of Canterbury. My interest in the Antarctic is primarily focusing on the regime, the Antarctic Treaty, which operates as a really interesting and quite a unique mechanism of managing activities and resources, which departs quite significantly from the traditional way of doing so, essentially state sovereignty and traditional approaches to jurisdiction. So from that perspective, it's quite a fascinating regime. Sadly, as an international lawyer, that means I don't actually have to go to Antarctica to do my research. I wish I did. I have been down as far as the sub-Antarctic, to Campbell Island and the Orkney Islands, but I'm still waiting to go to the Antarctic.
Is it likely you will, do you think?
I don't know. I'm open to offers.
Dan, you mentioned you cycled to Paris, but you cycled from the Antarctica?
No, so the cycle was a bit intermittent. So I started with fieldwork in the Antarctic. So we were looking at, with other colleagues at Gateway Antarctica, sort of how improving knowledge of how the ice sheets are moving off the Antarctic continent, which affects sea level rise around the world. And we're trying to improve these predictions into the future so we can better understand the implications for society. So I came off that fieldwork, came back to New Zealand, sort of planned the project from there, and then started the cycle. The cycling really got underway in Australia. I tried to find a way to get on a ship across the Tasman, but it's just so expensive. It's just absolutely insane. So the rest of the way I tried to fly as little as possible. I didn't leave the surface of the earth from southern China to Paris. So that wasn't too bad, but across some of the sea areas, it just became so difficult. To make it all the way.
That's pretty cool though. And somebody ran from the Arctic?
Yeah, so yeah. I was just one part of the project. So my colleague Ellen Ludson, who's a scientist who works in the Arctic, so in the other hemisphere, he ran from Tromso in Norway to Paris, I think 3,500 kilometers. So the idea, was just to do public speaking tours on the way and just get the media interested, but thinking, who are these crazy guys doing this? And then that gives you a platform to speak about the science. And it seemed to work. We managed to pull in, I think, 250 media articles, so we're quite happy with the outreach we managed.
That brings an interesting point, I think. And Karen, this probably ties into your work too, and the media coverage that these sorts of Antarctic issues receive. Does it much about the treaty, for example?
Well, in New Zealand, there's actually a reasonable amount of coverage because New Zealand traditionally has quite a strong interest in the Antarctic, both politically and scientifically. So you tend to get a reasonable amount of coverage of the main meetings for the Antarctic Treaty and for CAMLA, which is the Marine Resources Convention. And of course, late last year, with the adoption of the Ross Sea MPA, that was covered quite significantly. Outside of New Zealand, it's probably more of specialist interest. And I would certainly say that the Antarctic Treaty meetings are quite different from the climate change meetings, in that there's a much smaller NGO and media presence actually at the meeting. So whereas in Paris there have been several thousand NGOs and media outlets, in the Antarctic meetings, they sort of number on one hand. So it's much smaller in that sense.
Why is it so important in New Zealand, do you think? And this is a question for all of you.
Well, I'll start. It very much is our backyard, you know, so we're sitting here and next stop further south past the sub-Antarctic islands is into Antarctica. So I think just by its location, 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 so just simply by our geographical location, we should and we do have just a tremendous interest in Antarctica, just being in the New Zealand sense, our backyard. So I think that's just one very simple reason why we should be interested. And two, then, is the sort of whole climate change issue. So Antarctica's driving our climate systems, and what happens in Antarctica is really impacting the rest of the world. So that's, you know, and again, just being on our backyard, we have a responsibility, I think, to be interested and to find out as much as possible about what's happening in Antarctica. So that's just two points to start the discussion there, I think.
And I think if I could add to that, I mean, politically, of course, New Zealand is one of seven states which maintains a claim to Antarctica, so maintains a claim over the Ross dependency, so that gives it a significant interest. And it very much supports that claim, or at least maintains a presence within the Antarctic arena through the Antarctic Treaty. So traditionally, it is quite a strong player within the Antarctic Treaty system, so it takes traditionally quite a leadership role in relation to a range of interests there.
For those of us who don't know much about the treaty, You mentioned there are 7 key players, but I always thought that it was something that's all about the whole world is welcome to take part in the science and the exploration. It would be great to hear a little bit more about why are those 7 players different to the other players?
Well, the 7 players I mentioned are those which actually maintain a sovereign claim to the Antarctic continent. So that is New Zealand, Australia, France and Norway, and Chile, Argentina and the UK. The latter 3 have overlapping claims to the peninsula. So those 3 maintain a claim to the continent, but they're part of the broader Antarctic Treaty, of which there are 53 parties. And as part of that treaty, a really important part, in fact really the linchpin on which the treaty is built, is a provision which essentially allows all of the parties to cooperate, whether they have claims or don't have claims, recognise claims or don't recognise claims. So what it essentially does, and this is Article 4, it freezes the situation as it was in 1959. So those claims are still there, but for practical purposes, they're actually set aside. And that actually allows the states broadly to cooperate, even though they take quite different positions in relation to those claims. And that treaty is also underpinned by some really quite significant principles, including principles of freedom of scientific research and ideas that that research and the fruits of Antarctica scientifically and potentially otherwise should be shared between the Antarctic Treaty parties, if not the broader international community as a whole, although there are tensions with that question as to how broad that sort of sharing and cooperation goes.
I think if we're thinking precarious nature, maybe it's not just the physical nature, but the nature of the treaty too, perhaps.
Absolutely. So to the extent that states have quite different interests in terms of resources or in terms of how they think the treaty direction should go in the future, you're dependent on sort of this cooperative nature. And within the treaty, you have states such as China and Russia, the United States, all of which take quite different approaches, not only within the Antarctic Treaty Forum, but also more generally internationally. So it's a reasonably robust, but nevertheless, ultimately, potentially quite fragile arrangement.
I've always wondered this, though. If I wanted to go and build a base, like, how stringent is can a country that isn't part of the treaty just go and build a base in someone else's sector?
Well, Dan, you not being a country, being a national being, I'm presuming a national of New Zealand, it would essentially be New Zealand's responsibility as to your activities down on Antarctica. So all states which are party to the Antarctic Treaty have responsibilities in terms of what they're able to do down there. And there are rules in relation to essentially how you go about building a base, particularly from an environmental perspective. So if you wanted to do so, you could potentially, but you would essentially be governed by New Zealand's rules. What I guess is more interesting is if you have a country which is not a party to the Antarctic Treaty, the extent to which they are entitled to act on the Antarctic continent, irrespective of the Antarctic Treaty. And in theory they can. So as part of international law, treaties only bind those states which are party to them. So if a state is not party to a treaty, then they are at least technically not party or not bound by the rules under that treaty. To date, though, we haven't really had very much activity of states not party to the Antarctic Treaty actually operating in a significant way in the Antarctic. And those states which have evidence sort of an interest, such as Malaysia, have ultimately become parties to the Antarctic Treaty.
Something I've always wondered about as well is if there's a national of a particular country operating in a space that's governed, is that the right word? Governed by a...
Subject to a sovereign claim.
Okay, yeah. if a national of a country is operating in a part that's subject to a sovereign claim, are they bound by the rules of their country of which they're a national, or by the rules of the country that has the sovereign claim?
That's a very interesting question, and there isn't a clear-cut answer. In theory, all of those states which maintain a claim, in order to do so, would argue that their laws would apply to that part of the claim, because that's actually quite a significant part of exercising sovereignty. Given that those claims are not largely recognised, if they were to exercise that control or sovereignty, politically that would be quite divisive. So those states, in fact, do not generally exercise control over non-nationals within their territory. They may well do so if they have bases within their territory. For the most part, you would certainly be governed by the law of your nationality. And Most but not all Antarctic states have rules which actually apply to their nationals wherever they're operating on Antarctica. But of course in Antarctica you may well have a lot of nationals which do not belong to states which are party to the Antarctic Treaty, particularly tourists for example, and that can be quite a complex situation.
So we have a very good example, the US station McMurdo, the largest station in Antarctica, is situated on Ross Island, which is within the Ross Dependency that is part of New Zealand's claim. And that works very well.
New Zealand does not seek to exercise jurisdiction over McMurdo.
No.
Yeah, it's an interesting and complex issue, I would imagine. When you guys have gone down to Antarctica, what parts of Antarctica have you been to? Just the New Zealand governed parts?
Not for me, no, because I started working for the British Antarctic Survey and worked right on the very opposite side of the continent, so came down through South America and the Falkland Islands and down to the Antarctic Peninsula, and then worked really through from the Antarctic Peninsula through into the Transantarctic Mountains and across most of West Antarctica, really. So over the years I've visited the South Pole a number of times and worked pretty extensively across one third of the continent probably. Then coming to New Zealand, that was the opportunity to work in the Ross Sea and on Ross Island and on this side of the continent facing New Zealand. So I've been across quite a proportion of it.
Yeah, all my work's been restricted to the Ross Dependency, so the part that New Zealand is working in and claims, and it's been in a very restricted area really when you think about the size of the whole continent. So it's just been based out around the Scott Base and the McMurdo Station.
The size of the continent, just how big is it that we're talking here?
Okay, well, I mean, it's the fifth largest continent, so that doesn't mean much, you know, it means it's very big. And of course, in contrast to the Arctic, where there's no continent as such sitting on the North Pole, as everybody will know. But the best way is just about twice the size of Australia. And if you want another figure, it's 46 times the size of New Zealand. So it's very big.
And do we have a sense of how many people might be there at any one time?
In the summertime, there's way over 1,000. 2,000 people, probably up to 2,000 in the summer. Wintertime, way less than 1,000, with all the different countries operating there.
And that, of course, is scientists. I guess if you count the tourists, there'd be a significant number of people, perhaps up to kind of 35. I suppose not necessarily at one time, but over a summer period, around sort of 30,000, 35,000.
Goodness, yeah. That many?
Yeah. Yeah.
Over the summer season.
Yeah.
And
35 to 40,000 tourist visitors a year.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
How long is the season, the tourist season?
Yeah, it goes really from November through till April. So again, on the other side, on the Antarctic Peninsula side, the ships keep going well into March, April time. Whereas here on this side, operations tend to stop by February. So the US program and the New Zealand program pretty much pull out by February.
One thing that I think might be appropriate, given we're in an art gallery, is I'd be really keen to hear about your senses of Antarctica, particularly I guess the site, the physical description, but I've also heard sound, for example, and smell can be quite different down there.
Well, it depends how close you are to a penguin colony as far as smell is concerned. So yeah, people do go on about this, but I've camped really close to elephant seal pods and penguin colonies, and the smell's pretty horrendous. But equally, I've been to parts of Antarctica where, you know, very few people have been to. There's very little. There's no really mosses or lichens or anything happening there. And yeah, your smell's completely different. I think the thing that's so different about Antarctica compared to people working in mountainous areas in other parts of the world is just that daylight during the summer period. And I think that's one of the things that really affects you and really lets you know that you're actually in the Antarctic when you have that 24 hours of daylight and the sun coming through the tent at midnight and stuff. So that's the thing that really gets you about Antarctica.
Yeah, and to add on to that, I think it is it's where you are geographically in the Antarctic really affects your experience. I mean, I did my first two field seasons out on the sea ice, which is a very dynamic area, and at the coast, so you have the penguins and the seals, and all these animals, which makes it quite a vibrant, exciting place. But then the third fieldwork season I did was on the McMurdo Ice Shelf, and there is just absolutely nothing. So we saw one gull, I think, for 2.5 weeks. So it's very dependent on whereabouts you are doing your science.
How about you, Dan? What are your overriding descriptors of Antarctica?
Cold. So that third field season, we were in tents out on the ice shelf. So in the tent, it's minus 10, minus 15. So the only time we were there for 2.5 weeks, and the only time you're warm is when you wake up in your sleeping bag. I'm pretty bad in the mornings as it is. So getting up was pretty tough, but luckily I'd been put on radio. So I had to get up every morning to call Scott Base to tell them that we were all okay. Otherwise, I send out search and rescue. So that's a pretty good incentive to get out of bed. But yeah, that I really did struggle. That, you know, in the morning you've got to get up. All your breath is frozen as condensate on the inside of the tent. So you knock the tent and you're putting your clothes on. Then you get your own sort of, you get frozen ice going down your back. And then you get your clothes on and you get outside. All your clothes are pretty cold. You do your toilet things in the morning. And then you get into your day, but it is a fantastic opportunity to go down there and a privilege, but it is very hard work as well to work in this hard environment. I mean, we're given fantastic gear to do it in. So one of my overriding memories is always thinking how difficult it must have been for the explorers back, you know, who found this place and sailed across the Southern Ocean, which would have been a big enough achievement in itself, stay there for a winter, and then try to get to the South Pole with absolutely terrible gear. And it's just when you're standing there in the expanse of sort of Antarctica, you wonder how these guys, you know, did it on foot and with dogs. That was always quite a humbling experience to think, you know, those guys had put in that effort to get down there. Yeah.
Which probably leads nicely into the fact that this is very soon, I think it's the 20th of January, the 60th anniversary of Scott Base. Which I guess is a big milestone for New Zealand.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is another big birthday, really, and I think it's fantastic that New Zealand has kept that interest going in Antarctica now for those 60 years and kept Scott Base working there over that period. So I think that's what's important, I think, to me, is just that continuity. That continued interest of New Zealand as the whole sort of economy changes, the global interest changes, and yet New Zealand has maintained that long-term interest in the continent, which we hope will continue into the future. So, you know, we've been past 50, 60, so 60 is just it's another 10 years on. It's just a number in one sense, but it is that continuity of interest and investment in Antarctica over that long period of time that I think that's really the real importance of it to me.
Yeah, incredibly important to maintain the science as a time series, if you like. So the fact that there are no gaps in people going down to Antarctica and doing all this work is incredibly important for work into the future. So when scientists in 50 years look back, they can say, okay, this is how it was then, and we have a much better idea. So it's, you know, it's a really great achievement, I think, to maintain that across this time.
Does New Zealand's long-term engagement in Antarctica affect its relations, and I'm thinking particularly treaty, but I guess it comes into science as well, in how it engages with other countries in relation to Antarctica?
Yes, I mean, I think from a treaty point of view, it's actually quite a valuable forum to engage with other states from a diplomatic point of view. So I think it can be quite advantageous. So New Zealand's often perceived as a sort of an honest broker, a good broker. And that certainly also plays out in other forums, such as the United Nations, of course, New Zealand being on the Security Council over the last couple of years. So I would say, overall, it's actually quite beneficial in terms of its role that it plays within the treaty.
Yeah, I mean, New Zealand is seen as one of the big players in Antarctic research and Antarctic science, and yet we don't invest near as much as some of the other countries, so we do get a good investment on our... a good return on our investment in Antarctica. So I think it's really important that New Zealand maintains that sort of leadership role in many aspects of Antarctic research and Antarctic science by continuing to invest and continuing to be involved. And And, you know, if you look, if you stand back and look at it, in one way, it's one of the big key areas where we do cooperate with the US, and those, so that's a sort of very important relationship around Antarctica between the US, for example, and New Zealand, and now we're building up important relationships with South Korea, with China as well through Antarctica. So I think internationally it's really, really important we continue to do that into the future.
And given we're based in Christchurch, Christchurch is one of, I think, just three gateways, is that right? Jumping off points to Antarctica. So I guess what's the role of Christchurch in all of this? I mean, it was easy coming up with the panel, for example. Sometimes it's a bit difficult, but, you know, Antarctica experts sitting on the doorstep, which was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, so there's the five cities, Hobart, Punta Arenas, Ushuaia, and Cape Town, so pretty much spread around Antarctica. So yeah, I mean, the early explorers have been coming here since the 1800s, late 1800s, 1900s, so we have that sort of historical link to start off with. And or with the US program based here, Korea have an office here now, and maybe China in the future, and Italy, and the New Zealand program being based here in Christchurch. It's just so important to the city. And, you know, the return on the investment is something like $120-130 million a year. So it's a massive amount of money, and really, really important to Christchurch as a city. And very important, actually, that we try and grow that into the future, and that we become what people refer to often as the sort of exemplar gateway city to Antarctica. And the Christchurch City Council has just invested in an Antarctic office that opened about a year ago now, and we're trying to put together a sort of overall strategy for the city on how we develop this link, further develop this link with the Antarctic, and continue to invest in it, and really make Christchurch the important stepping off point for the continent. So it's, yeah, massively important to the city.
I didn't realise that about the council, actually. That's a big step.
Yeah, that's a very big step. Mm.
We touched on it briefly, and I'd really like to get back to it, is the importance of the science. And Dan, you mentioned the kind of the longitudinal idea that people keep on going back, keep on doing presumably the same tests. It would be great to talk about what's the importance, what's the relevance of the science.
Yeah, I mean, there's a vast array of different science going on down in Antarctica, so I can only speak to my area. So yeah, we talk about ice for a bit. I got some stats here. So yeah, the Antarctic continent is about 14 million square kilometers. So Brian pointed out earlier, it's about two times Australia, and 98% of it is covered in ice. So one of the big concerns with climate change as the planet is warming. So I think the analysis just came out from the World Meteorological Organization that last year is the warmest year on record. So we're looking at about 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So things are starting to get pretty serious on the climate change front, and how that impacts the Antarctic is a big question in the scientific community, because there's all this ice there. And the main impact that is going to affect the planet is sea level rise, so like I touched on with Bangladesh earlier. So basically you've got all this ice up out of the water on the Antarctic continent, and as the temperature increases, it's expected that it will begin to melt as the atmospheric temperature increases and as the ocean temperature increases. At the moment, the Antarctic is losing about 120 gigatons of ice. So you get, with the climate science, you get all these numbers thrown at you all the time and have no idea what they mean. So a gigaton of ice is a billion tons of ice. And one gigaton is equal. So if you imagine Hagley Park, completely covered in ice, and then you went up to the height of the Sky Tower in Auckland, so a big block of ice the size of Hagley Park and up to the height of the Sky Tower, that's one gigaton. So Antarctica is losing 120 of those every year. Its little brother up in the Northern Hemisphere is losing twice that, Greenland is losing twice that, coupled with thermal expansion. So we've got this ice going in, and then as the globe warms itself, as you warm water, if I put this in the microwave for 2 minutes, this water would actually expand. And that is happening to the oceans as well. So the oceans are expanding from thermal expansion. You're having this input of ice from Greenland and Antarctica, and also the mountain glaciers, like here in New Zealand, like Fox and Franz, are also melting. and that increases the sea level. And what scientists are trying to do is establish how fast that's going to happen. And a lot of that depends on how quickly we respond to climate change and how much we let the planet warm. So sea level is currently rising at about 3 millimeters a year, which doesn't sound like a huge amount, since about 3 centimeters a decade. So the best possible scenario we can look at by the end of the century is that that stays the same. So we're looking at sort of 24 centimeters by the end of the century is the best scenario. But given what is happening in the world at the moment and that CO2 levels are going up, the global temperature is going up, and there isn't really a solid plan to bring down emissions rapidly, we could be looking at anything up to a meter by the end of the century. And to bring that back to what that means for the rest of the planet, Bangladesh, which is one of the most vulnerable countries to sea level rise, is so flat. 1 meter of sea level rise in Bangladesh will displace 30 million people. And that's just one country. So often we put these effects on sort of low income countries, but that has serious consequences for New Zealand as well. You know, coastal property and the impacts of storms. So coastal property will lose its value. This is a thing that's been massively underlooked all around the planet in places like Florida. You know, you have millions and millions of dollars invested in coastal property, which is ultimately valueless because in 100 years, potentially, it won't even be there. So these are massive links to society from the Antarctic that is difficult sometimes for people to draw. So that's one of the sort of the main component of the science from my perspective. How does that tie into yours, Brian?
Well, I'll just go back to those long-term records, which is where your sort of question started. And
Daniel, answer was excellent too.
And you know, one of the things that scientists were measuring for really since the stations were set up in the 50s and 60s was measuring ozone levels. And I remember there was a review of the British Antarctic Survey, and one of the things the reviewer said, you know, why the heck are you continuing to measure those ozone levels? They never change, and let's stop doing that. And the survey kept on doing it, and lo and behold, in the next 5 years, they discovered, you know, one of the major discoveries coming out of the Antarctic, which was the hole in the ozone layer. And that had major implications, obviously, for changing human behavior around releasing CFCs into the atmosphere. So that's just a very good example of some of the long-term monitoring that's gone on in the Antarctic. And another very good example really is temperature measurements. You know, scientists every day in the Antarctic that they're there over the winter, over 2 year periods, go out, measure the temperature, record it, and the longest record goes back to 1958 to one of the British stations. And it's shown we've had 3.5 degrees of warming on the Antarctic Peninsula since that station was set up in 1958. And that's simply someone going out every day, measuring temperature, recording it. And that sort of thing has been happening right across the whole continent. And that's just two examples of really valuable records that have been measured. And sometimes that we don't know the importance of some of those measurements we're taking at this stage, and you just need maybe 100 years of records to see how, because our globe changes really, really slowly, but we're obviously in a period of more rapid change, and yeah, it'd be amazing to come back in 100 years' time and see what really has happened.
Mm. Scary, I suspect.
Yeah.
I'm also thinking as well of ice cores and the science, what the science is telling us from those ice cores in terms of global changes in temperature?
Absolutely. I mean, I actually think the ice core record is one of the most important records to come out of Antarctica, period, really. It's just been so important for us from a number of perspectives. I mean, one, the first thing is, the Vostok ice core record goes back 430,000 years. So that's a sort of climate record for 430,000 years. That's really amazing in itself. Another ice core goes back 800,000 years. But what they're showing us, one is cycles of climate change, which we sort of know about. But the important thing about that is we're really on top of a natural warm period and our Earth should be cooling due to natural cycles. So that's really important in terms of climate change to start off with. And I think the second thing that's really important about this ice core record is that it shows that going back over those 800,000 years, carbon dioxide levels in our atmosphere have never been above 260 parts per million. And we're now up at 400 plus parts per million. And that is really the clincher in terms of the impact that human beings are having on our planet and our climate. So that's just two really, really, really important things that have come out of that ice core record with the scientific research that's gone on in Antarctica, really only over the last 15 years.
Yeah, and for people that don't know, I think it's really interesting. So these ice core records, for people that don't know how they're recorded, so basically the Antarctic continent is 14 million years has it been around? What's the geology on that, right?
For the Antarctic continent?
Yeah, been the ice sheet, anyway.
Oh, no, the ice sheet's been around, permanently for 15 million years.
Okay, so you've got this big chunk of ice, it's been there for a very long time, and into more recent geological history, sort of hundreds of thousands of years, the snow has fallen from the atmosphere, and as the snow comes through the atmosphere, it grabs a fingerprint of what the atmosphere was at that time. So it keeps a trace of all the gases that were in the atmosphere. That snow falls onto the Antarctic and then gets compressed as ice. And what the ice cores do is drill through them, and they can retrieve from years in the past and retrieve these gases, and they can tell you, that's how you get these time series of the gases in the atmosphere. And that tells us how serious some of the changes we're seeing now are.
We're sort of slowly running out of time, so I've just got a couple of questions to finish up, and one of them is, are we seeing any action being taken given what we're seeing?
In the world? Yeah, New Zealand, we're going to cut our carbon emissions by 30% from 2005 levels by 2030.
Yep.
We've signed up to that.
And that's it?
Well, of course, the
seriously.
COP21, which Dan mentioned a few moments ago, I mean, that was very important in December for establishing an agreement which will enter into force in 2020 in order to replace the Kyoto Protocol. Many would argue that states are simply not going far enough, though. One of the significant differences between the Paris Agreement and the Kyoto Agreement is that whilst on the positive side, all states are potentially covered, so not simply the developed states, but also developing states such as China and India. But on perhaps the less positive side is that states actually decide their own commitments. So they're actually indicating what they are going to choose to commit to over a period of time. So of course a very interesting question is whether those commitments are going to be sufficient. So as part of the Paris Agreement, we have a formal commitment to try to limit global warming to 2 degrees, but with an aim to try to limit that to 1.5 degrees. So I think with that there are a couple of questions. A, is that achievable on the basis of the commitments made by states? But B, and this is one for the scientists, you know, what does a 2 degree or indeed even a 1.5 degree actually mean? So in some areas, particularly in the oceans, which is the other area that I'm quite interested in, a 2 degree warming is actually quite significant. So there certainly is action, and I think the science in Antarctica is so important in terms of being used by policymakers in order to try to get change, in order to try to change the behaviour of states and indeed individuals. But I guess the question is how much we are changing and whether that is sufficient.
Yeah, I think to summarise Paris, I think politically it was an incredible achievement, but on the scientific side of things, we're just so far behind where we need to be. Like I said earlier, we're at 1.2 degrees already, and as Karen mentioned, 1.5 is the lower target for the Paris Agreement, so things are looking a little tricky there. So I think just international efforts have to be massively accelerated to catch up with the science on this. And with old mate Trump in the States now, it seems a little bit, you know, there's so much uncertainty, and there seem to be forces coming together that are completely contrary to the agenda that is required. So I think it's incredibly important now that we sort of work out how to combat those forces and find a new way forward to really put a dent in greenhouse gas emissions over the next sort of 15 years, really. That's what needs to happen. So we need to work out clever ways to get around these guys who have a different agenda.
Are you feeling like the Antarctic science is getting much of a voice in these negotiations? Are people actually referring to it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a I think people are looking now at what's happening in Antarctica more and more. So I think so. I think the IPCC reports, for example, they include chapters or sections on Antarctica and how fast the ice is melting and so on. So I think the international community is becoming well aware of the importance of Antarctica. So I would say yes, but that doesn't say we need to keep hammering away at it and making sure we're getting our message out there.
And just a final question for you, Karen. Are there any learnings that you think the Antarctic Treaty can demonstrate for other international law?
Yes, I think there are quite a few. In a way, the Antarctic Treaty was very much a sort of a pioneer at its time. So this idea of managing a continent, which we've heard is twice the size of Australia, through a cooperative agreement as opposed to through more traditional notions of sovereignty, I think is significant. The principles it establishes in relation to freedom of scientific research, environmental protection, are important, but also perhaps some lesser known principles. So, for example, a really important principle under the treaty is freedom of inspection, this idea that inspectors from Antarctic Treaty consultative parties are entitled to inspect the stations and facilities in Antarctica. And that actually provided a precedent for some of the weapons treaties where you have those principles of inspection. So it's already sort of provided some quite important principles. And I think as a really interesting kind of cooperative regime, it certainly does provide a potential precedent and options for elsewhere. Of course, it is beginning to creak a little bit under its sort of infrastructure, which has been around for over 50 years. So I think managing sort of the new pressures in terms of interest and resources, things like bioprospecting, the various interests of other states will be quite key over the next few years to get that cooperative or to keep that cooperative regime going. So there are pressures there.
Have you guys got any final words before you open the floor for questions?
No, very happy for some questions.
Yeah, let's go.
Great panel. Thank you all. That was really, really interesting. So I just returned from Antarctica last night, and I'm really buzzing from the experience, and there's a thousand things that I want to ask, but I'll try to limit it to one thing. I guess you touched on this briefly, and a conversation that came up when I was down there, I was at Scott Base for about a week and a half, was about tourism and whether it's a good thing and whether it's a bad thing. And something that, you know, I've only been back for less than 24 hours, but something I found really quickly is that it's impossible to describe Antarctica to anybody. Like, you can show them pictures, you can say the standard things, like, it's great, it's amazing, like, the vistas are huge, but, like, it's such a visceral experience being there, and not just the environment, but the people and the base and the science and everything else. And that's almost impossible to communicate, I've found. Maybe that gets easier, and you guys can answer that. But I guess my question is then, is more tourism a way to give people access to that experience so that they understand maybe the pros and cons or the necessities of preserving it in a way? Because, you know, it's for a lot of people, it's a big abstract continent at the bottom of the earth that you don't think about that much. So is that good or bad? Because I was there under the banner of Antarctica New Zealand, and if a muesli bar wrapper fell out of my pocket, there was like a safety form and a form I had to fill out saying how we would prevent that from happening again. But presumably, tourists would not be subject to those kind of stringent regulations and different things. So I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I'll start. I mean, I think to start off with, I think the tourist industry is quite well managed. So, in fact, they did set some standards about people going ashore and disinfecting their footwear and their boots and stuff, which you know, scientists and support staff in national programs don't do. So they actually do some things that that we don't do. And I think that their environmental standards are pretty good. And of course, the standard positive response is that these people become advocates for Antarctica, for climate change and all of this. And I think that to a large extent is absolutely true. So, and really, you know, we're talking about 40,000 people in a continent that's twice the size of Australia as well. So the negative is that a lot of the ships tend to go to the same, they take the people to the same place. So we have to look at the carrying capacity of each of the sort of hot spots that the tourists actually go to, whether it's historic huts or penguin colonies or seals or whatever. So these are the places that are easily accessible. So I think broadly, provided the industry is continued, is managed well, I think it's broadly a reasonably good thing. My panel members want to disagree, or?
No, you go for it, Karen.
No, I wouldn't disagree. I mean, I think the argument about tourists becoming ambassadors for protection of the environment, protection of the Antarctic, is quite important. I guess the only other sort of factor which has been sort of on the regulatory agenda over the last few years is actually the safety of tourists, particularly ship-based tourism. So there was certainly a spate of quite a number of accidents sort of from about 2000 to 2007, 2008 involving vessels. And of course, given its location, given the harsh conditions, there are quite significant risks to tourists and of course then to infrastructure scientists who might be involved in search and rescue. So there's some quite interesting, quite hard questions associated with tourism. But I guess the question is, if you sort of shut it off, if you confine it to the scientists, is that appropriate, sort of essentially simply designate a continent to science, or should not a much broader range of people have an opportunity to experience what Antarctica is like?
Yeah, I think I agree with both the broad statements, but I think there's a cautionary side there as well, especially related to the fact that most people go to the peninsula, which is relatively easy to reach from South America. But if you're thinking about the Ross Sea, it's an incredibly hostile place. You know, we're not just talking about going with the family to the beach for the weekend. It's an incredibly big undertaking for tourist operators to do. And I think that opens a huge bag of, like you talk about search and rescue and how, you know, it's an incredibly hostile environment to go to. And where has been touched so far is just the easiest place to get to. So going into the Ross Sea and these other sectors of the Antarctic, which are very dangerous marine areas, I think is potentially, it could be quite hazardous to people.
I have a political question about the treaty, and currently there are some quite resource-hungry countries around the world. I'm thinking of China. Do they present obstacles to the continuation of the treaty?
No, they don't present obstacles to the continuation of the treaty at this stage. So there's certainly been interest in Antarctica from an economic, from a minerals point of view, from those states, China, Russia, being two examples. There's no doubt sort of recent ratifications, including Malaysia, are potentially also motivated by, you know, long-term treaty interests. At this stage, I think we're assisted by the fact that those resources are very difficult to get at and certainly not economic at this stage. And I guess the crunch comes when, or if and when, that changes. So at the moment, there's actually a ban on commercial minerals exploitation. But that ban can be reviewed in 2048. Now, that doesn't mean it'll be lifted. And if it is lifted, there does need to be a minerals regime in place in order to manage that industry. And, of course, there was, in the 1980s, in fact, an entire treaty which was negotiated and indeed adopted but never entered into force. So I don't think it represents an immediate issue, but there's no doubt that interests in economic matters, minerals matters, do underpin some states' interests, and that may well influence how they behave within the treaty. And of course, to an extent, that's also tied back in to the issue of sovereignty and control, because to an extent, that also has implications for minerals. So these issues are all potentially connected.
I think we have to hope that by 2048 that we've lost interest in oil and really to succeed in a sort of climate change world, that has to happen. So we have to move away from our obsession with oil. And it is oil that would be the thing that causes a change in 2048, because there's undoubtedly oil reserves there and they're probably not that difficult to get. And so we just need to make sure that we've gone off oil by then. And we have to.
Yeah. I mean, we've already seen the progression, the standard human progression of the model we're on at the moment. The Arctic is melting, and we're trying to get into the Arctic to drill that now. So I would imagine the same would be in the Antarctic if we were allowed to go there. So exactly, we have to find a new model to work with so we don't even need these minerals anymore.
Brian, you said earlier that, of course, Christchurch is a centre for Antarctica, and we in Christchurch probably know quite a bit about it in the lay population. But is there anywhere within the organisations involved with Antarctica that has an advocacy role spreading the word, if you like, to the Northern Hemisphere and other populations that aren't as close and don't know anything about the importance of Antarctica?
I don't know. I don't think there's anybody taking on that more global advocacy role that you're talking about. We're obsessed, I guess, with getting the word out in New Zealand. And, of course, as scientists, we go to scientific meetings, but we're talking to the converted. So, no, I don't think anybody's taking on those international roles in such a way. And I guess it comes down to capacity and capability in actually doing that.
I'm just seeing Jeff kind of waving his hand around. Are you doing a plug for TEDx Scott Base?
So I was just in Antarctica at Scott Base as part of the production crew for TEDx Scott Base, which is a TEDx conference being organized and presented at Scott Base. It's going to be broadcast internationally on the 22nd. So that really was... It was a collaboration between TEDx Scott Base as an organization and Antarctica New Zealand. So they wanted to do it as an advocacy and a promotion for Scott Base's 60th anniversary, which Brian mentioned. But it really is a global advocacy effort. We have viewing parties on every continent on the planet and over 60 viewing parties, and it's going to be broadcast around the world. So there's, I think, an increasing effort to spread internationally beyond just New Zealand. Oh, and there's multiple viewing parties in Christchurch if you would like to go.
Hello, I'm Jenny. Thank you very much for such an interesting talk, and all the questions are really interesting as well. I suppose because you're living, working and breathing in this area and the enormity of the challenges with regards to climate change and getting people to change their behaviour, what thing keeps each of the panel hopeful about that we can overcome those challenges?
Big question.
Yeah. Well, I actually believe we will. We will get there. But I actually think it has to get a little bit worse. We have to see the water sort of lapping over the roads, and it has to just really convince people that this is really happening and we're really into this big time and the change is just going to carry on unless we do something about it. So, but I think we're getting close to that now, and I think then the investment has to go. And so I actually do think we can do it, but then we have to get the government legislation behind us to actually make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, they've been huge positive changes within the last 2 years, even though I may have sounded quite pessimistic earlier on the science side. From the human perspective, it's been incredibly impressive, really, from COP21, the Obama administration dealing with the Chinese, and now China is blasting ahead with solar and wind. So there are massive turnarounds with renewable energy globally, and it's just a case of keeping that going and making sure the investment stays and getting that just global capacity for renewable energy to where it needs to be. And I completely agree with Brian that it will happen. It's just a case of how much damage we're going to have to deal with the amount of time we waste at the moment. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm quite so optimistic, I must admit. I suppose on a positive point of view, the sort of longer term history of the human race is that humans have overcome a whole range of challenges, and we now have cures for diseases, we have solved some environmental problems, the ozone layer being a really interesting case in point. So there are certainly precedents of where human behaviour has significantly changed, and we've improved the lives of not only humans but other species. I guess the challenge with climate change is that it is also all pervasive, and it requires significant lifestyle changes from pretty much everybody that lives a typical Western lifestyle, and persuading people to do that is very challenging. And I guess one of the things that concerns me is that climate change is only part of the puzzle, and of course there's a lot of discussion now that we're essentially in a new geological age, the Anthropocene, and that focuses not just on climate change but of course a whole range of changes that we're actually making to all sort of ecosystems and habitats, whether that's oceans in relation to ocean acidification, changing to natural freshwater ecosystems, terrestrial ecosystems. So the changes really are quite significant, and they are across the board. So, but I like the optimism of the other two members of the panel. So.
Any final questions?
What I found out about awareness for making climate change a little bit more knowledgeable and so on, I was now invited very often in schools and they did Antarctic projects. And I think to make changes, we have to really to start to educate the children already, because they have an enormous impact what parents are doing then in the end. And so I think communication is one of the key issues, and I think this is one way how we do it now. And also young early career scientists have a special forum what is only communicating Antarctic issues. And I think when we get out a little bit more there, then we have maybe more chances to change. It's not a question, it's only a statement.
Okay, well, that seems like a nice positive. Actually, I feel like almost every show we end up saying, what do we need? We need to talk more. Yep, educate. So we'll finish this show much like we finished all the others, saying communication is really important and we need to be discussing these sorts of issues. So I would just like to say a massive thank you very much to our panel for coming in, giving up a nice summer evening, and Brian's still on holiday, so particular thanks to him for coming in. Thank you to all of you for coming along to our first live recording. It's pretty exciting. And keep an eye on our Facebook and Twitter pages for some of this info. Don't forget TEDx Scott Bass. Jeff's just done a plug for it, so 22nd of January you can watch the live streams. Thank you very much. And thanks also to Coca for hosting us.